Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 46 of NML Crossing, otherwise known as The Finish Line. Because today we are officially wrapping up the pre-No Man's Land era for the Bat Books. We're going to put it all to bed today. And, you know, before we get into that, speaking of finish lines, when I was sharing the last episode of the program on whatever the hell we're calling Twitter nowadays, I saw that Krakoa was trending, which sent a shiver down my spine. I just don't like I hate it when the stuff that I like trends, because it's usually not good, right? So I clicked on it like an idiot, but found out that looks like they're officially ending the Krakoa era. And while, you know, this really isn't the forum to discuss X-Men stuff anymore, you know, that was a different show. I gotta say that that's the first X-Men news I've heard in a while that makes me somewhat excited. You know, there's been the 97 stuff, there's been talks of movies, and none of that stuff does anything for me. I hate that stuff. That stuff just reminds me how little the anybody cares about the actual comics anymore. So we're getting actual comic news here, and in my opinion, it's good news. Because while the Krakoa era was a lot of fun, it was very creative. It, like most things in comics, it outstayed its welcome and outstayed its usefulness, at least in my opinion. But thought I'd share that since, you know, I spent thousands and thousands and thousands of hours talking about the Krakoa era. I figure it's only fitting that that I say, you know, a few words about it being shifted from, before us to the rear view. Not a second too soon, perhaps a couple years too late, though. But, we'll see what comes after that. I'm, for the first time in a long time, excited to do my pre-orders on the X-Men comics. I still do, because, as we've talked about, I'm an idiot, and I still buy things that I very likely will not read or do not enjoy in hopes that I eventually will. But, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm still waiting for that other shoe to drop because I don't know what's coming next. And, there are a few things that I'm scared of. But we won't talk about that here. Instead, how about we continue down the road to No Man's Land and we get off at that final exit, right? In order to do so, however, we're going to have to go through one last book. And that is Detective Comics number 729. Set a February 1999 cover date. The story's called Fight or Flight Part 3, 30 Seconds to Midnight. Written by Chuck Dixon with pencils by William Rosato. Ink Sal Buscema. Colors Gloria Vasquez and Android Images. Letters John Costanza. Edits Peterson and Vincenzo. And a cover price of $1.99. We open with a full-page spread of devil heads. Now they're being commanded by, guess who? Ugh, Nicholas J. Scratch, in order to track down and kill Bruce Wayne. If they fail, he says he will personally strangle the geeks with their own guts and then boil them in their own blood. From here, we return to Gotham City and we rejoin the Boys Wonder. Now they talk about how weird everything currently is. You know, everything's over, but not quite yet, because Gotham still has about an hour left. They compare it to, like, the last week of school, which is fitting. You know, when you're in high school and you have, like, those last few weeks that are just testing, you know? It's like school's over, but it's not over. It's different. The dynamic is different. Even walking through the hallways of the school during testing feels different, right? It feels alien. And so I really like that descriptor here because they're trying to do their normal patrols here, but it's a different world. But it's still the same for a little while longer. It's very cool. Now we zoom out and we see that our heroes are being trailed by like a 1990s version of a drone, which is kind of modeled to look like an insect. Now they're being watched by that weird jawed cybernetic guy from the end of the last few issues. You know, one of Nick Scratch's, you know, legal losers. We next shift over to the roof of the GCPD HQ, where Jim and Sarah are standing over the busted bat signal and discussing what's next. Now, neither of them are all that hopeful, which, you know, all things considered, stands to reason, doesn't it? They head downstairs, where, to their surprise, they are greeted by several members of the GCPD who are willing to stick it out and fight for Gotham City even after the closure. Now, among the crowd, we see some notables like Harvey Bullock, Renee Montoya, and Hardbach. You know, if only Ballistic decided to stick around, right? Maybe had Doug Mensch stayed in the Bat Office, he would have. Now, Gordon smiles broadly, and he compares their current situation to the 1948 John Wayne film Fort Apache, which I've never seen, so I got nothing to say about it. We jump back to the boys' wonder as they get to a vantage point in order to watch over the General Cadwalader. Cadwalader? Okay, Cadwalader Bridge, which in this book is the last artery into or out of Gotham. I swear, we get a different last road out in every single book, don't we? I think we've had like three or four bridges already named as the last, you know, way in or way out. Here, it's the Cadwalader. Now, Cadwalader is spelled here with two L's. The the Cadwalader with one L served under George Washington during the American Revolution. He commanded the Pennsylvania troops. I would assume that it's named after him. Now, as they look on, Nightwing kind of recoils a bit, believing that he'd just been bitten by a mosquito. But instead, it's a weird electrified robo-bug dispatched by that weird-jawed creep. Now, Weirdjaw, he makes his approach, now wearing like an insectoid bottom half. Kind of looks like whatever the hell Mojo sits in, just a smaller version. In a true Claremontian fashion, he introduces himself as Gearhead while punching Robin in the mush. He then wraps Nightwing up in his electrified coils and escapes with him, but not before giving Tim a message to pass on to Batman. Gearhead wants Batman to meet him under that bridge, the Cadwalader, in 1 hour, or else Dick dies. Probably when they, you know, blow it up. We jump over to the bridge and we rejoin Cobra Commander. Remember him? Well, he's still here. He's stood atop a bulldozer, fomenting a crowd of angry Gothamites, threatening to bulldoze their way out of Gotham. Which, is it just me, or aren't we still in that grace period where people are allowed to and encouraged to leave Gotham? Like, why the big show? And why all the threats? Just walk across the damn bridge, you idiot. Anyway, over to the clock tower where Tim is frantically calling into Oracle, hoping that she's got the deets on wherever the hell Batman is. Well, she hasn't the foggiest and wants to know what's so urgent about Tim's request. Now, he reveals that if Batman doesn't show up at the bridge, Dick's gonna die, which, unsurprisingly, suddenly gets Babs on board with the plan. Speaking of Dick, we rejoin him tied up under the Cadwalader Bridge, where Gearhead is talking a bunch of trash. Now, Dick keeps things glib, which only irks our baddie. This interaction is interrupted by the voice of Batman. Now, this gets Gearhead's attention, probably because Batman doesn't actually exist, right? It turns out that this is just Robin using, like, a voice modulator. Topside, Cobra Commander and his bulldozer start plowing toward the other side of the bridge. The hooded geek is hit in the dome with, like, a rubber bullet, which knocks him not only off the bulldozer, but off the entire damned bridge. Back under the bridge, shots begin ringing out. It's a troop of devilheads who, are they competing with Gearhead to kill our heroes? Because it looks like they're going at it. Like, the Devilheads and Gearhead are fighting now. Why? They all work for the same idiot. Okay. Amid the distraction, Dick and Tim escape. They jump into the drink below. Gearhead vows to kill Nick Scratch for this, which, hell, have at it, pal. Do it. Do us the favor. Down in the bay, Dick and Tim drag Cobra Commander out. Just then, the bridge goes boom, stranding the Devilheads on the Gotham City side of things. On shore, Dick and Tim unmask Cobra Commander, where he's revealed to be Simpson Flanders. A TV shrink who we first met during Nightfall, and, you know, saying it out loud, now I understand the punny name, the Simpson Flanders. Oy. Okay, up top, the Devilheads try contacting Nick Scratch for an extraction, and he ain't answering his phone. So it looks like they've been abandoned in Gotham City. What's more, they're about to run afoul of one of the city's most prominent citizens. the Joker, who shoots them all dead. Thank you, Joker. We close out the issue and the era with Dick and Tim returning to Wayne Manor to wait for Batman to show up. Thing of it is, upon arrival, they discover that the manor has been plowed down into the cave. And that is how we leave them. Next time out, finally, no man's land. Now, our letters page, detective comments, are all about the Brotherhood of the Fist stuff, so we're skipping it. All that's left to do is, I guess, talk about this. You know, I hate repeating myself, he repeats to himself. But what's there to even say here? The road to No Man's Land has been not great. Really ungreat. Bordering on bad. In a lot of cases, dipping into bad. This was just kind of there. It feels like, I mean, we've said it before, this is filler. This is time filler, so, you know, the bad offices can put all the pieces in place for No Man's Land proper. Sometimes you could do this in a way where it's value added, right? If we were to use modern comics parlance to describe this, or at least my version of modern comics parlance, it would be this is a lame duck period. You know, I call pretty much everything Marvel Comics does nowadays, it's cyclical, right? You go from event to launch to lame duck to event to launch to lame duck. And there's really very little variation in that little triptych there. You know, you launch a book, you give it maybe one, maybe two good arcs, then you announce the big event that's going to relaunch everything. And so you still have those 3 or 4 months to fill to get to the event, and that turns into your lame duck period, where nothing happens, you're treading water, and it's just an exercise in killing time. And then you get to the event, which blows everything up, and never really ends in itself. But from the event comes relaunches. So you get the launch, you get maybe one or two arcs, and then you get, ooh, another event's coming. So lame duck for a few months. Sometimes you're able to make something productive out of the lame duck period. And my big comparison here, because like I said, I have read the first issue of our No Man's Land thing here. I've read No Man's Land number one. And it's a bit of a culture shock. And I can compare it to the way I felt when I read Grant Morrison's first issue of X-Men. You know, it felt like a totally different world. Familiar, but different, right? And forward-thinking, progressive, just a whole new kind of take, a whole new kind of prism to view something very familiar through. You know, so in the build-up to the Morrison run, there was a lame duck period. You know, from the failed Claremont return, between the failed Claremont return and Grant taking on the book, there was like 2 or 3 months where they brought back Scott Lobdell. And I remember, because I was a lot closer to comics reviewing and comic reactions back then, and just comics news in general. And I remember people were kind of turning their nose up at that, thinking like, oh, yeah, we don't need to buy these books. But they actually managed to add value. You know, they saved the newcomers, you know, Grant Morrison and Joe Casey, from having to shuffle the pieces into place, because Lobdell took care of that. You know, he got rid of the legacy virus, killed Colossus, reestablished Cyclops as not being part Apocalypse. He really put everything where it needed to be in order for the new takes to hit the ground running, right? Sometimes you get that. Most of the time you don't. We could think, keeping it with the X-Men, and we were talking about Krakoa earlier, thinking about Hoxpox here. In the lead up to Hoxpox, definitely a lame duck period, which added nothing. It was very, very poor comics. And you know, the guy who wrote them is not a bad writer. It's just, there was nothing he could do because nobody cared anymore. And I actually did an in-depth analysis of like sales figures for that run of X-Men. And they were pitiful, like very like shocking that they still were produced with the numbers that they were moving before Hoxpox. So sometimes you're able to use those extra months, those months that you're trying to fill productively, and other times, well, you get the road to no man's land. We get 12 books about Nick Scratch nebulously doing something for some reason. We don't know what, we don't know anything about his motivations. Why is he doing what he's doing? Why does he hate Gotham so much? What does he hope to get out of this? Does it even matter? Will it ever matter? Like, will we have a, will we have insight as to the importance of Nick Scratch by the end of No Man's Land? Or are we just going to forget about him? I mean, I was looking, I had a doctor's appointment this morning, and I was on Usenet on my phone, you know, the old Usenet archives here, and I just typed in Nick Scratch and Nicholas Scratch to see if anybody had any comments about him. And, well, everybody agreed that he's terrible. he's up there among the worst bat villains of the 90s and 2000s. I think they had him alongside, like, I think it was Madame Macarena. There's actually a character from Asriel, a villain, called Madame Macarena. That's unfortunate, isn't it? But Nick Scratch is in the same rarefied air as Madame Macarena to the, you know, to the opinions of random Usenetters. But as for his motivations here, I saw some theories, nothing confirmed, and I mean, you figure if something was going to come out of this, we'd know about it. A lot of theories that he used, you know, mind control. I don't know if that'll ever be confirmed or denied or whatever, but it's silly that I was reading posts from after No Man's Land ended where people still didn't know what Nick Scratch was all about. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to learn a whole heck of a lot here, and the fact that the entirety of the road to No Man's Land is predicated on the whims of Nicholas J. Scratch, it makes me feel like we wasted a lot of time. 12 episodes, many, many, many hours of writing and recording and sharing, and all of it for a lame duck period and a lame duck villain who manages to find even worse people to put in his employ. Like, the four geeks we got here. I mean, they weren't, like, really introduced like a wrecking ball or anything. It was just, like, one of those classic last pages in comics where it's like, oh, well, I've got our Suicide Squad, and here's this group of weirdos. But they all sucked, and none of them did anything. We had our assassin with the big bun in her hair who missed the... She had one job, one shot to take, and she missed. And then we never saw her again. We have the Gimp. We have the Gimp who might be dead. We have this gearhead guy. We have the dude with the jackhammer. We have all these devil heads. It's just so awful. To the point where, I'm not going to lie, when I see actual Nick Scratch on this page, I'm kind of happy to see him, because all these other characters suck so much worse. It's like, these last couple of issues, one of my main complaints is not enough Nick Scratch. How the hell did that happen to us? It's like, we're focusing too much on the idiot with the damn jackhammer. Where's Nick Scratch? At least I can laugh at Nick Scratch. This guy just sucks. And I mean, this is Chuck Dixon's last issue from his very, very long run on Detective. His very long and great run on Detective. To go out like this, that's just too bad. I would have to assume that he was just being a good soldier here, getting the job that was given to him done, because he is capable of so much better than this. This issue, this arc, these past couple of arcs have been confusing, kind of muddled. Like, what was the deal with the Cobra Commander guy? Why couldn't they just leave Gotham? He was just some dude. Just walk across the damn bridge like the millions of other people walking across the damn bridge. Why? And the reveal, why were the devil heads fighting with Gearhead? Where does that make sense? They're all working for the same dude with the same mission. It just doesn't make any damn sense. It feels like we didn't miss an issue, but it feels like we did. I don't know. For someone who hates being negative, I'm being pretty negative during this Road to No Man's Land era. And I apologize for that. I don't want to, I don't know, dwell on the negative and maybe even over-exaggerate how bad something is by repeating it over and over and over again. But I didn't enjoy this. I enjoyed this one a little bit more than the Batman three-parter, the Mr. Wayne Goes to Washington, but not much more than that. Out of these 12 issues, that Shadow of the Bat three-parter was the best, and even that was a little bit extended. But I think that's all I got to say about this. Thankfully for all of our benefit here, the road to No Man's Land is over, and starting next episode, we are in the thick of it. A new world, Gotham City at this point is done. From this point on, it's only No Man's Land, and I can't wait to share that with everybody, and I hope you're all along for the ride. Speaking of being along for the ride, how about we hop into the NM mailbag here before we cut on out here? We got a few letters that we'll discuss today. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu talking about Detective number 727, which we discussed in episode 44. He says, at least Babs and the GCPD had color TVs to watch this time instead of the black and white ones, which was weird, wasn't it? It was weird that in the Batman three-parter, everybody had black and white TVs. I don't know. He continues to say, I like the Dick and Tim team. They have such a big and little brother vibe to them. I wish they actually did more together. And that's true. That is true. If only they were in a better story. Because this just felt. I mean, I don't want to keep going into it. Chris continues. Firefly burning down a section of Gotham City that had already been abandoned just adds to the incompetence of all of Nick Scratch's goons. None of his plans have been executed correctly, and it's almost comical by this point. And we still have no idea as to why he's doing any of this. Yes, these people suck. These are the worst heavies you could ever hire. And at the end of the day, we don't know why they're being hired, and we may never know. Chris continues, the only reason I can imagine is for why the road to No Man's Land was 3 months long is that they must have needed those 3 months to get all the writers and artists in place to begin No Man's Land proper. For me, it would have made more sense to start No Man's Land with this issue, Detective Comics 727, being that it is a Batman anniversary issue. Even I could write the marketing for Detective 727 being the start of a new Batman era or the end of Gotham as you knew it. Once again, DC editorial drops the ball just inches away from the goal. That would have been perfect, right? The 27 is sacred in Detective Comics, right? Now more than ever, because we do whatever we can to crank prices up on things, but and for some reason make every anniversary a really lazy love letter anthology to whatever character stars in it, which I've written at length about that. When we do anniversary books on Crisis on Infinite Earths, I remember Action Comics 1000 being very disappointed by that. You know, because you wait 1,000 months for this landmark, and or give or take, because we did have Action Comics Weekly. You wait 80 years for this to happen, and what do you get? You get something that feels like a throwaway annual, you know, and like where you'd expect the issue to include like a 3-page little thing about everything that's in Batman's utility belt, and a cross section of the Wayne Tower with all the rooms inside with secret gyms and maybe a fire pole to get to the basement or something, all that kind of silly stuff. But I mean, the timing couldn't have been better for this. We actually had a 27. We have this all new era being ushered in. Why not? Why not make it special? Instead, it was just an issue. And I do get that it was the late 90s, and I think there'd been like a backlash to that, to the, you know, making everything special. Because they did over, I mean, the comics industry, if they do nothing else, they do overcorrect often. You know, we go from famine to feast far too often in comics, where we had the first half of the 90s, all the the excess. You know, we had the foil covers, the oversized books, the special chromium, whatever the hell's. And then I think we thought we were too cool for that, too smart for that in the late 90s. So that all kind of went away. And like everything was like, oh, no big deal. Nah, oh, Uncanny X-Men 400? Nah, no big deal. We'll bring in a weird artist and not really celebrate anything, not commemorate anything, not make it seem like it's any more special than issue 399 or 401. So maybe we were being too cool for school, or maybe they just didn't care. Who knows? Who knows? But it would have been cool to look back on that 27 as being something a little bit more special than it actually was. I remember like 627, they did that gimmick where they had several retellings of the first Batman story, the whole chemical conspiracy or whatever. I don't remember what it was called exactly. I know I covered it on the site, but it was just different takes on that first Batman story from Detective 27, and that was pretty cool. And I'm trying to think if they did, I don't know if they did anything for 827 either. There was no 927. We had another regular 27, and we've had 1,027 as well. But those were more of the love letter variety, unfortunately. But would have been cool, could have been cool, and I totally agree with Chris here that the road was as long as it was because, yeah, I mean, they haven't really been secretive about, you know, how they're adding new members to the Round Robins, the Round Robin storytelling that we're going to get in No Man's Land. So I'm thinking the editorial team was probably very, very taxed at this point. And I would assume, without any knowledge, of course, that all of the creative teams that they put in place were probably already writing their arcs at the same time. And there was probably a lot of coordination to be done, a lot of trying to figure out what order these books were going to go in, what order the arcs were going to be told in. Not to go too far ahead here, but at least the beginning of No Man's Land, it's going to be a lot of turf warfare. You know, a lot of protecting neighborhoods, taking over neighborhoods, claiming neighborhoods. And I would assume, again, without knowing, that the editorial teams wanted to make sure that they limited as much redundancy as possible and made things as cohesive continuity-wise as possible. So, like I said, I think they were taxed here. You know, it's not a huge editorial team. You know, when we were covering X-Men books, it wasn't unusual to have like 6 or 7 editors on a single book for whatever reason. And they still had continuity errors and spelling errors. Word balloons going to the wrong people, despite having a platoon's worth of editors on the book. Here we have a very lean editorial team. I think we've had 3, maybe 4 editors overall. And a couple of those were Justin Azrael, you know, because I guess Denny wasn't editing his own book, so they brought in Mike Carlin and someone whose name escapes me right now. But very lean editorial team here, so I'm thinking that this 3-month little jaunt was to buy some time. And fair enough, you know, fair play. I do wish a little bit more attention was paid to these books. And again, I can't say for certain that it wasn't. You know, this story, this arc, these multiple arcs here in the Road to No Man's Land might have gone exactly according to plan. They might have looked at this and said, that is perfect. It could not be any better. 10 out of 10. Who knows? But thank you so much for writing in and sharing your thoughts there, Chris. And I agree with pretty much everything you said. Next up, we're going to go to our friend CJ talking about Batman 561, which we discussed in episode 42. Now, this was the weird issue where every other page was a splash. It was Bruce Wayne's testimony. And CJ says the following. Although the execution of the stylistic, formal device used in this issue, with every other page being a splash page of a different scene with the hearings dialogue overlapping it, I do like the potential of that approach. I think the poor execution came down to 2 flaws, the second of which ties into one of the bigger problems you mentioned in this episode. 1, the scenes they picked to illustrate these splash pages are almost all about Batman's past instead of Gotham's past in the current situation, which seems to make tying it into the dialogue from the hearing about rebuilding Gotham flimsier. The villain spread seems like the closest thing to actually being close to the content of the hearing for Gothamites, not just Bruce's life. Things like the Ra's al Ghul spread are the weakest because they have very little to do with Gotham's current state. Yes, it was loosely tied to Scratch's demons, but that's a weak connection, especially since we've only seen him in that one Chronicle story. And yes, I was actually going to mention this because Chris, you had mentioned as well the reason for Ra's al Ghul being there when Batman was talking, or when Bruce was talking about demons. And yes, I do know Ra's al Ghul is the demon's head. But as CJ says here, it's flimsy. It is flimsy, and it's like, I don't know, it feels like they were just kind of, like, tipping the hat to Denny there. It's like, okay, cool. And I do have that Ra's al Ghul bias. I have that allergy to most things Al Ghul. I don't find him interesting. I don't think he's all that great. I've yet to read a story featuring him that has made me want to read more stories featuring him. And I've got a lot of stories featuring him. I actually just bought, I came across a first print of Son of the Demon at a record store for like $5. Not in the greatest conditions, but you know, it has a nice looking spine, and it'll sit on a bookshelf just fine. And you know, I was reading through that, and it's pretty good. And then you get to the Ra's al Ghul stuff, and I'm like, oh man, anything but this, please. And I mean, the story is all about Ra's al Ghul, of course, but, or it has a lot to do with Ra's al Ghul, but not one of my favorites. Maybe I just have a knee-jerk reaction to groan when I see him. Maybe maybe Nicholas Scratch will take his place in my my nightmares from this point on. CJ continues. Two, this point is somewhat related to the last point, but since these scenes are largely tied to Bruce or Batman's past instead of Gotham, it does make Bruce seem disconnected and like he didn't really know what he was doing in his defense of bailing out the city. It seems like these scenes are more for the reader's benefit, even if they don't connect to the dialogue all that well. This stylistic device or approach is tricky to do for this reason. The overlapping dialogue and images need to have the dual effect of making sense to both the people in-universe and to the comic readers. And it seems like this only succeeded with the latter, and even then, only partly so, since so many of these images were more about pre-Cataclysm. And I agree with that sentiment 100%. I never claimed to be a writer. I would like to be a writer. I'd like to say I am, but I don't think I have the talent for it. I know I don't have the work ethic for it. But I would imagine that this would be a difficult thing to make work. And of course, we're spending far too much time with it, right? Me especially. I'm dissecting this and analyzing it. And I'm projecting those sort of my analysis onto anybody within earshot. So we are really, we're thinking about this, these scenes that I don't want to say they don't warrant it, but at the end of the day, they're really not a big deal. So it's, you know, put Ra's in there when you mention the demon, that's fine. People, the readers will get it. But it, I mean, you take those pages out and you just have Bruce say what he says, because that's what the people in the book are seeing. It just doesn't land. It just really doesn't land. CJ continues. Somewhat shameless plug, but it's relevant to this point. I use this type of approach to a degree in the final issue of the fourth and final volume of Rebirth of the Gangster, the comic I write. And I know I tried hard to avoid this trap. I didn't do the every other page was a splash panel, but the frame story was a speech for the falling action part of the story, which also echoed a speech in my first issue, connecting to the rhyming point that Chris, you made a few days ago. And that rhyming point was talking about Alan Grant starting and ending his run on Shadow of the Bat with an Arkham story. That speech's dialogue served as a transition to check in on the other members of my cast and their final fates. Making this approach avoid the top issues, especially issue 2, was very hard, and I don't think I was completely successful with it, although I think my successes outweighed the failures and made the approach worth it. This might be a long way of saying that my own writing experience might still make me critical of how this was done in this Batman issue, but I have more sympathy and understanding for the failures than I would have otherwise. Creating my own work has helped me do this a bunch when reading comics, And I think it's one of the reasons I recommend people create on their own to see how hard it can be and how, and to be less upset when creators don't do things well, even if we still don't like the product itself. And that's an excellent point. Like I just said a few moments ago here, I wish I could say I was a writer. I used to have delusions of writing, and a lot of those kind of came to a head in the past few years and led to my self-imposed exile. When you realize that time is slipping away and you're running out of opportunities to do the things you really want to do with your life, and you kick yourself for all the years you spent not doing those things, but talking about them. See, that's a trap with writing, you know. Writing is a trap if you don't have the work ethic to... And I'm going totally into the weeds here. When you're a writer, when you fancy yourself a writer, you can convince yourself that talking about writing or thinking about writing is writing, and it's not. I'm totally, like I said, I'm so deep in the weeds here, I can't even see the sun anymore, but that is the writer's trap that I found myself in. So CJ here talking about, you know, these gimmicks that he put into his writing, gimmicks isn't the right word, but the approaches that he uses, or he used in his comic here, make me wildly envious that he actually managed to get something done. But makes me feel very small in comparison, because I was making fun of editors having, you know, word balloons go to the wrong people. I couldn't even think of three words to put in a word balloon. You know, I would sit there in front of a blank page until I rotted. Which is probably why the analysis portion of any kind of project I take on is the hardest for me. You know, because I hate saying bad things about things that people work on. You know, I don't think any writer wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to write the worst story featuring Batman today. Or I'm going to write the worst X-Men story ever. I don't think that happens. You know, I think everything, or most things, are done in earnest. And so that's why it's really... It's like pulling teeth for me to be critical sometimes. And at the end of the day, who the hell am I? And what the hell have I done that warrants me being able to rate or opine on something anybody else did? Back to CJ here. He says, I got a few different notes here. This is about some of the comics we were talking about in an earlier mailbag. He says, the Jed McKay Avengers is pretty good. The best Avengers for me since Busick Perez. Not at that height, but better than Aaron's or Bendis's stuff. Aaron and Bendis had some good moments, but overall, I didn't care for their runs. I did like I like a lot of McKay's stuff, Moon Knight and Doctor Strange being some of the bigger ones. And, you know, I do have, like, the first few issues of the McKay Avengers here. I haven't read them. I'm trying to think if I liked... Because I know McKay did some Spider-Man stuff when I was trying to do that Web Lapsed show. And I can't remember if we liked him or not. I don't know. Despite owning a whole lot of them, I really don't have much interest in Moon Knight or Doctor Strange, so I don't have much of a frame of reference for McKay's work. But I do have those Avengers issues. Maybe one of these days I'll pull them out here. The Aaron run. I thought that started out okay. I remember reading like the first five or six issues, whatever the first arc was, I read... Because I was trying to prepare for the AXE thing for X-Lapsed, the Avengers, X-Men, Eternals, Judgment Day? Judgment War? One of those things. I was trying to prepare for that, and I figured it would be, you know, behoove me to be familiar with that run of that era's Avengers, so I was going to read the entire volume. And I made it like two arcs in, and I thought it was okay, but... And then it got into the weird multiversal stuff, and I do not care for that. I really, really don't. Back to CJ. He says, also, I really enjoyed your X-Men vignettes, and I like those stories themselves a lot overall. Like Chris Yu, I caught up or re-listened to your stuff during your hiatus. I did this too. Reading your blog and those vignettes were one of the best things from my time doing that. The vignettes were fun. The vignettes were a lot of fun because for a lot of those, that was my first time reading them. I, for some reason, and it's weird, for being as completionist-minded as I am, there are some books that like scream from the 50-cent bin for me to pick them up. And I mean, we talk about the Ray, right? I mean, I bought the damn Ray, and El Diablo. But when I'd see classic X-Men or X-Men Classic, I would leave them behind. I don't know why, but I just never picked them up. Same with Shadow of the Bat. I see Shadow of the Bat all the time. I leave them. Now I want them and I can't find them. But Classic X-Men was a book that I just did not feel like I needed. You know, I have like 99% of the books already in their original form, and I was just like, I don't need these. And then I started picking them up. And then I got into that wild hair to do the vignettes project, and it became one of my main priorities in bin diving. And when I started that project, the only vignettes that I'd read were the ones in the trade collections that Marvel had put out probably, boy, 15, 20 years ago. There were two volumes of X-Men vignettes where they collected a few, maybe like six backups in each one, maybe. And I read those and I enjoyed those, but I never really prioritized reading more of them. So, the Vignettes Project facilitated me reading a lot of those for the first time, and they weren't all winners. There was a lot of Ann Nocenti stuff, which was, well, it was Ann Nocenti stuff. But, for the most part, I had a lot of fun with it, even some of the Nocenti stuff. So I'm glad that I did it, and I'm overjoyed that that people enjoyed it as well. That means a whole hell of a lot. CJ continues. Also, I wanted to let you know that your work has been a resource to me in my research for articles and books on comics history. For example, I'm writing a book called Comics Tell Us the Truth: A History of Nonfiction and Informational Comics in the United States. And I have a chapter on superhero PSAs. The Cosmic Treadmill episode of the Teen Titans PSAs and your blog posts about them have been very helpful. Don't worry, I'm not lifting your stuff word for word, and I'm giving you and Reggie credit. Maybe knowing this will ease some of the loneliness of writing podcast producing you mentioned. Chris, you seem to do too, probably in a better way than me, that I also know from my own creative experience. And I mean, that's what it's all about. When Reggie and I started, we were on the Weird Science Show, which was very tonally different. Even though Reggie was a large part of that show, our segment was very tonally different. It was not a fan favorite when we started up, because Jim and Eric are they're funny dudes. You know, they're funny guys. Reggie and I, when we were together, we were like old professors. You know, we were boring. We were dry. We were trying to talk about history, not about, you know, the ephemeral books that were coming out at the time and having a good time with it. We had a mission state to, I hate using like a word like educate, but it's like we were trying to just show people some stuff they might not know. And, like I said, it was not a fan favorite in the beginning there, but it was always supposed to be a resource. That was something that people could take and add to and do further research or maybe take the research in a different direction. We just loved being part of the process, you know, and resource is just the perfect word for it. That's helped me get through a lot of my pseudo creative struggles is the understanding that what we're doing here is a resource. And I used to get really hung up about that because I would look at all the work I'd put into something and I'd be like, I'm just making it easier for someone to steal, you know, but that was the cynical me. That was the cynical me, not really, you know, missing the forest for the trees, you know, just not really understanding my place in this. And not that I have much of a place, but I like that our work might be, you know, one brick in someone else's wall, you know, where it's going to live on, and it's going to find new life as part of someone else's research. And that's one of the things that that keeps me sane, I guess. More, I guess, relatively speaking. I remember early in our Weird Comics history experience, we got a message from someone who asked us if we knew how to APA citation a podcast. You know, like if you've ever written anything in APA format, you have your bibliography and your resource page, and it's all very boilerplate. And he was doing some, I don't remember which episode it was. It might have been the Comics Code. It might have been the Comics Code. He was citing us for an actual academic assignment. And he's like, "Hey, I have all this information from you guys here, and I've got you quoted. I just don't know how to cite you on the res on the on my reference page." And I remember looking it up and trying to figure out if there was a way. But this was like 2016, so there wasn't really anything there. I'm not even sure if there's anything there now. But I remember thinking that was really, really cool. I was still a student myself at that point. So the thought that something I did was going to be potentially cited on someone else's work, I just thought that was really, really cool. So thank you so much for that, CJ. That really made my day. That's so cool. And I read this message a few days ago, and I wanted to reach out to you personally. I probably still will, but that really does mean a lot. So thank you so much. Next up, we got Billy D talking about episode 44. He says, "Hey Chris, I'm glad to hear the show keeps rolling on. Although sometimes I think you might unknowingly be a masochist. This episode sparked a memory in my brain from years gone by. I immediately thought of the trifecta of 80s detective cop shows. One, Hardcastle and McCormick. Two, Jake and the Fat Man. Three, Nick Scratch and the Gimp." Well, that's all for now, but again, great to hear you back on the airwaves consistently. I tell you, it's great to be back consistently. Not only from just the leaving a mark on a day. So that was a big thing for me. In doing work or work, not even work, putting something out there every day, whether it be a pile of words or a pile of talk, I felt like I was leaving a mark on the day, you know. And you know, not to get too precious about things, a lot of days there I wasn't feeling like that, you know. During the hiatus, I was kind of living in a haze, you know. Couldn't tell you what day was which, couldn't tell you anything I had achieved or accomplished in a long, long time. It was a very, very dark time. Just walking around, walking from the bedroom to the kitchen was a victory, which is really sad. But it's nice to be consistent. Just from a, you know, me being able to leave a mark on the day. It might be a tiny, mostly insignificant mark, but it's still something I can sign my name to. And I don't know if I could say I'm proud of it, but it's something, which is better than nothing. The consistency is also cool in just communicating with people, because I was talking to nobody. It was brutal. I'm sure there were whole days that went by where I didn't hear the sound of my own voice, much less anybody else's. So it was not a good time. So it's nice to be back in the conversation again. It's nice to have people reach out. It's nice to be able to reach out. And it's nice to have people reach out and not to ask if I'm still alive. Rather, they reach out to just say hey, and that's super cool. But thank you so much for writing in, Billy. I really, really appreciate it. But I think that's where we're going to end things for today. We're ending the road to no man's land. Thank goodness. Next time you hear from me, well, things are going to be a little darker. Things are going to be a little muddier. Things are going to be a little scarier. Things are going to be a little less batty. Because he's going to disappear for a little bit. And I can't wait for us to enter that leg of our NML Crossing journey together. And of course, if you'd like to join in the conversation, I would love for you to do so. You can reach me all those different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, ChrisandReggie.podbean.com, all the socials and whatnot. I definitely look forward to hearing from you. And now let me awkwardly segue into our close by thanking you all so much for joining me today and sharing some of your day with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks.